welcome. My name is Julian Schlossberg, and the name of our show is Movie Talk. Welcome to part two of my interview with Barbara Feldon. She played Agent 99 on the hit television series Get Smart. She was nominated for 2 Primetime Emmy Awards for that show. But she's also done many other things, including writing 2 books. So we're back, and let's talk about those other things as well. Let's talk in terms of all these terrific shows you did, being able to sing and dance, where your talent as a singer and a dancer showed. And we can start out with 5 shows with Dean Martin. That's a lot of shows to do with Dean Martin. Is it true he couldn't stand to rehearse? Is it true that he just had a wonderful time doing his show?
Oh, absolutely. I think that was the deal with the producer, Greg Garrison, who was spectacular, and that, you know, Dean liked to play golf and he didn't want to work hard, you know, in doing this. And so I think they made it possible for him, and in the course of that made a hugely successful show.
It was sensational to watch.
Yeah. Yeah. I never actually met him except in the scene we were doing.
Again, chemistry, it looked like the two of you were having a romance.
Yeah. It's so much fun because he didn't rehearse, so that it was up to you to get a reaction out of him.
Yes.
So that added a little more fun to even doing the sketch, because he sort of knew what he was going to be doing. Probably he read through it once, maybe not. The teleprompter goes up and he's just reading his lines. And then he's just so surprised at everything that's going on around him.
And it's so obvious that he's reading the teleprompter. He's looking right at it, not even looking at the other actor half the time.
No.
But it didn't seem to matter. The audience loved it.
And it was part of it. You know, I think that was part of what made it work.
Now it's all on the web. I've watched it a couple of times. You singing and dancing with the biggest movie star during World War II, Van Johnson, who was the number one box office star in America during the war. And there you are. You must have watched him in movies. And there you are dancing and singing with him. This has got to be unbelievable for you.
It's the gold ring. I mean, it's winning the lottery. One day I showed up at a rehearsal for a Dean Martin show, and they said, "Van, you're going to dance with Van Johnson in this show." And I was 8 years old watching him in theaters, you know, during the war. And you can see I'm usually pretty verbal, but just trying to describe the magic of meeting him. And I mean, I met so many big stars in Hollywood, because you just bump into them. They're just there like birds sitting on a fence. I mean, you meet everybody, and they're your contemporaries. And they don't impress me that much, because I'm doing a show and they're doing a show, and it's like, okay, hi. And Van Johnson, oh my God. I loved it. He was so sweet. He was just dear.
I had such a funny, I directed him in a little film we did together called Going Hollywood, the 40s. Yeah, I produced and directed. But I want to tell you, after the show, we went out and had dinner, and we came out of the restaurant. We were on 6th Avenue. I'll never forget it. And 2 little old ladies ran up to him, and they say, "Oh, my God, it's you. It's you." He said, "It is. It's Van Heflin." And they got so confused. They knew that he was somebody, but they didn't think he was Van Heflin. It was really kind of fun that he was able to kind of make fun of him. Do you know that he painted a lot? He was a real big painter, a lot of canvases.
Wow.
Yeah. And his canvases were like Guernica. They were gigantic, huge. And he sold them all over the world. Yeah, it's interesting. So there you are dancing, singing with Ben Jonson and working with the great Dean Martin. And you even have a sketch or two with Lloyd Bridges. So you're really working with a lot of people.
Yeah. I mean, there because those shows, especially the variety shows, they had like a number of stars on every show. So if you've done a number of those shows, it's a whole lot of, you know, meeting people, but not necessarily getting to know them or everything.
Oh, no. And you're singing with Anna Maffo. You're doing, yeah, you're doing.
Can I actually sing with her?
Yeah, you do. I don't understand the Parisians from Gigi. And it's on the web, Barbara. You can see it.
How did I ever have the nerve to sing with Anna Maffo?
You'll be very pleased. You did well. You did well.
I'm glad. I'm so relieved.
And you did. We should point out you did the Carol Burnett show. You did Smothers Brothers. You did Rowan and Martin's Laughing. You were doing the biggest variety shows in the business. So that Get Smart did pay some good dividends.
It did. That was a nice fallout.
Now let's talk about the movies, because you've made some interesting movies. My favorite of all the films you did was Smile. I thought Smile was sensational film.
You have good taste.
You were great in it. You played one tough cookie, a real ice cold mama, but a beauty contest winner. And it was a wonderful social satire, probably too smart for the room, as they say, but it was a hell of a movie. I hope it wasn't too tough a shoot.
Michael Ritchie is really a treasure among, you know, movie makers. And his view of American culture. He had been a judge on a beauty pageant in Santa Rosa the year before, and he said that he realized what a good movie you could make out of this, that's both a satire and really a loving kind of appreciation of America, you know, the silliness of some of the things, the hugeness of the cars, you know. It was a wonderful experience. And I'm so glad you liked the movie, because I think it is, I think it's really a very special.
It is.
And it's funny. It's funny. When I was making it, I thought I sort of slightly didn't approve, because I thought they were making fun of the people in Santa Rosa. But when I saw the movie, it was very sweet. It was affectionate. And yeah.
And it's funny, too, because sometimes a movie's ahead of its time. And years later, they made Little Miss Sunshine about the same kind of idea of beauty pageants, et cetera. And that was a big, big hit. So you never know. And we should point out that Michael Ritchie did the early Robert Redford movies. He did Downhill Racer. He did The Candidate. He even did The Bad News Bears. He was quite a director and died rather young, sadly.
What a shame.
But now we'll go to working with Del Mann, who was a wonderful director from television and did Fitzwillie with you. And you co-starred with one of the nicest people in show business, Dick Van Dyke. And I hope he was nice with you.
What can you say about him? I'm sure you've interviewed him, like the nicest man in the world. You know, a gentleman. You know, nothing that would make you uneasy about him. Nothing that would make you anything but but amenable to him.
And such an interesting character, too, because he admitted that he was an alcoholic in life and went to AA, got straight, and I don't think he ever went off the wagon again. But he'd be, if you were casting, you'd say, oh, he'd be the last person I would believe would have an alcohol problem, you know. But it's very interesting, too. You have in that movie Dame Edith Evans. And I always wondered, how do you address, you say, Miss Evans, Miss Dame, Dame? What is, how do you, did you talk to her? Did you get to know her at all?
And I didn't, oh no, we, none of us did. I mean, we were like, we were tiptoeing around her because we were so impressed with her. But, and none of us, like the first day, knew how to address her. And so finally, I don't know if it was the AD kind of very diplomatically said, we would like you to tell us how we address you. And she said, oh, don't be formal. Just call me Dame Edith.
Great. Great. Well, that was a lot of prestigious people working on that movie. The great John Williams did the music. And you don't get better than that. At that point, he was known as Johnny Williams, but he was doing the music. The Mirisch brothers were producing it, and they were at the top of their game. So a lot of things looked very good for that film on
John
paper.
McIver, you know.
Yes.
Was in it. I don't know how it did. But it still plays every Christmas.
And I wanted to talk about working in a Disney movie. No deposit, no return. You're working, we said earlier, with the great David Niven, who I just loved from afar and got to know just a tad. And Don Knotts, it's a different kind of a film for you, isn't it?
Yeah, I played a mother, I think. That was different for me at that time. The fun thing about doing the movie, aside from David Niven's, when I approached my trailer the first time, and there's Mickey Mouse pointing to the door. And so everything on that lot is Disney World, you know. So that was amusing. And just being around David Niven was amazing.
I wanted to ask you, while doing Get Smart, you must have found out either during it or afterwards that you had become a role model for young women. Because after all, and television in those days, it was the only time a woman was the brains of the outfit. It was quite obvious that you're the one who's saving the day. You're the one who's figuring things out. And a lot of women say that this was a big change for them. Did you know it at the time?
No, at the time I didn't. At the time I began doing the show was just, the women's movement was just beginning. I mean, this is the second wave of the women's movement. Obviously, the first wave was getting the vote in 1920, but Betty Friedan Downs' book had just come out, I think probably the first year of the show or maybe around then. And Simone de Beauvoir's book, The Second Sex. And I read them with interest, but there was not a movement at that point. And I was not, my consciousness about my power or anything had not been raised. I was just trying to please mostly men because they were running the show. So I was not aware of that as being an issue. I was just doing the script. It wasn't until probably toward the end of the series when I began to appreciate how that fit in with a movement that was really getting legs at that point. And 99 was way more, you know, evolved in terms of feminism than I was when I played her in the beginning. And but later, these women come up to me and say how important that was for them to have that image in their mind that a woman could be smart as a man and smarter and you know, come up with the solutions. And yeah, so that was nice. I mean, we're all grateful to Mel Brooks and Buck Henry for writing her.
I didn't write 99.
No, you didn't, but you incompetent. You certainly took her on, that's for sure. No Deposit, No Return were some very interesting character actors. I don't know if you got to know either of them. I was thinking of Darren McGavin and Herschel Bernardi.
Darren, I knew because I think the first thing I did after George's show before Get Smart was a two-character kind of performance. It was a series called The Nurses and the Doctors.
Yes.
In the
1960s,
early 60s.
Yeah.
And it was
Zena Bethune.
Zena Bethune, yes. Yeah. And she wasn't in this particular episode, so I never met her. But this particular episode was really starring Darren, and I was his love interest. And that was an extraordinary experience because of his kindness. I was very new to doing television. He was made sure that he was not shading my face and that I was not getting in his shadow. And, you know, he was showing me the ropes, and he was very charismatic, but very, very kind.
How did you handle rejection in the business, which is not an easy thing? Because obviously, despite the fact that you became a television star, you were still going up the ladder before then and going out and trying out. Was it very tough on you?
I personally did not handle rejection well at all, or criticism. I was super sensitive, but I did understand the process of auditioning, and like 60 people are auditioning and you don't know if you have all of the right qualities, you know, the color of hair and eyes and whatever. And I don't remember feeling rejected. I just felt like I didn't get that role and what's next. Once you're at a certain level in Hollywood, you don't feel rejection because you're not privy to it. You know, you're not auditioning. They either offer you the role or they don't. So you get rejected in the writers and producers meeting when your name comes up and they say,
oh no, we don't want her. We don't want her. Right.
You don't know. You're protected from that information. So I must say, when I was out there, once you have a certain level of name quality, you're treated with tremendous kid gloves in your presence. Who knows what horrible things were said about me, you know, in private, but I didn't know, and I'm glad I didn't know.
Yes. Well, I wanted to say that we had mentioned Lucien, the man you were married to, the man who you thought worked for the CIA and was this incredible, charming man. But what's so wonderful about your book, Getting Smarter, I want to show it again. It's a terrific book. What's so wonderful about it, you don't make yourself out to be a victim. I mean, the reader feels you've been victimized, there's no question. But you don't feel you're a victim in the writing of this. And I tip my hat for you, because I don't know if many people who went through what you went through could do it that way. But you did. And I love what you said. You said, I had lots of dreams and he helped me fulfill some of them. And that was that you were a dreamer. And he, and boy, was he a storyteller.
No, he was a classic sociopath. Somebody who lies with ease and who can take advantage of people financially, and told fabulous stories about his background, none of which were true.
And have no guilt. Have no guilt.
Well, and that's the thing I understood later that gave me compassion. Compassion, aside from the fact that that it was the greatest adventure of my life. I mean, to be 24 years old and believe that the KGB is chasing you through the streets of New York, you know, I mean, and you're with this unbelievably glamorous, handsome, oh my God, French guy who's working undercover, and you're his girl, and he's protecting you. And oh, it was, I mean, he created an adventure to me, for me, that if I had married somebody who was really appropriate and, you know, on their own 2 feet and, you know, really successful in a certain way, I would have missed a huge, you know, life thrill. And I'm grateful for that. And I was madly in love with him. And not everybody gets to be madly in love, you know.
As your mother said to you.
As my mother said to me, when she later said, you know, it was fortunate that you knew him, because not everybody gets to feel that. And so along with my philosophy of exploring life, I got to feel, you know, that extreme romantic love. And I left him, you know, if he had left me, it would have been harder. But I left him finally after 9 years. And then I've had a lot of therapy, and I did a lot of reading on sociopathology. And a sociopath's brain, that part of the brain where the conscience is not as active, as developed as it is in a normal person. So that in a funny way, he was doomed at birth, you know, to be without a conscience. And then his real history of being a refugee, and there was just so much to feel compassion for, and he gave me a huge gift, you know. And the money didn't matter, as it turned out. I was successful enough, you know. I'm not huge, really rich or anything, but successful enough to get through.
I have to say, I have to give your father points on this one. He saw through him right from the beginning. He didn't fool your father at all.
No. No, those Puritan guys, they just look right through any, or skeptical of any kind of showmanship, you know.
And sadly, he predicted what happened, pretty much.
He did.
Yeah. And
and I was furious at the time.
But... Oh, you were devastated by that, especially from the 6'5" father, not approving of it. You wanted him. And I love that expression that your mother didn't say, but in essence did say, it's better to have loved and lost than never to have loved at all. And that's the truth. Was there ever, did you ever want to do, for example, since you were an expert, quote, in quotes, on Shakespeare, did you ever want to do Shakespeare professionally?
I did, but nobody wanted me to. I was this, you know, comedic actress on a...
Might have been a great Ophelia.
And who knows? I'll never find out. But later, I did do lots of poetry readings, and I read lots of Shakespearean sonnets. And that was a great, great pleasure. So in a smaller venue, I was able to experience Shakespeare
Well, and since we know you could play an ice cold woman as somewhat in Smile, and also that play you did with Lawrence Luckenbill, you played a pretty cold fish. You could have done Lady Macbeth.
Maybe so, or maybe Hamlet's mother.
You could, Gertrude, yes. Gertrude.
Might have been, good. It was so easy to be evil. It just shocked me because of my good girl image,
Well, but you are a warm, compassionate, charming woman. So when we saw you and Smile, couldn't believe it. Just couldn't believe it.
Yeah, it was, honestly, it was some part of me that just wanted to get out, I guess. I liked her. Because, even if you're playing a villain, you understand their motives and you take their point of view that they're right in the way they feel and act. But it was so, she had this stiff hair, that the wind would blow her body away before it would touch that hair. It was just so rigid. And she was so cold. And she could be so curt and superficial. It was surprising to me and so easy to do,
It was surprising for an audience, believe me, to see you that way. Yeah. And it was an interesting cast, you with Bruce Dern, a young Melanie Griffith.
Yeah.
Annette O'Toole, a lot of younger actors were in that film too with you, but you really dominated in that film. And did they ever ask you, because they did a Broadway show of Smile. Did you know that?
I did know, and evidently it was really not a good idea.
No, but they didn't come to you to do it.
No,
they surprising. There was Marvin Hamlisch, in fact, did the music. To it.
I think they wanted who played her?
I don't know. Once it wasn't you, I wasn't interested.
Yeah, they probably wanted a Broadway singer.
I don't think it was a star. I don't think it was a name.
A musical?
I don't think it was a name. Definitely a musical. Howard Ashman did the lyrics. Yeah. I felt very fortunate to get to know Carol Burnett, and she was in our home, and we'd have dinner with her. And like Dick Van Dyke, it's amazing when you find people that you care for so much as from afar and get to know them, and they are what you thought they were, what you hoped they were.
Yeah.
I hope you felt that way with Carol as well.
I only met her, I may have done a sketch with a number of people and her, but when I was on her show, I did a song dance number that was not involving her. And also the sketch that she and I were supposed to do got canceled at the last before we did it.
Oh,
they took it out of the show. So I never had the pleasure of really getting to know her.
Yeah.
We said hello at a couple of events,
Yes.
And, yeah.
Well, on the bucket list, besides Shakespeare, what else would you like to have done that you still may do, perhaps?
You mean acting-wise?
Acting-wise, or in life. It could be in life, visiting the Kremlin. I don't know.
Something novel. Something that, always... What if I were asked that question, I always would have said Chekhov play, The Seagull, play Madame Barkovna in The Seagull.
Yeah. Yeah.
I never got that opportunity. So those are things that would have been wonderful to because in college I did, I did a Chekhov play in college, Uncle Vanya.
Uncle Vanya, yes.
And it was like another life, doing
it. Yes. Yeah.
But the relationships, they, Oh, gosh. I mean, you forget that you're even on a stage. You're just living this life. And I always wanted to be cast in a Chekhov play again, but I never was. And so, I mean, that's like sort of bittersweet. But in terms of, I'm curious about the adventures that can be had. I mean, I have no particular interest in acting anymore. I love writing. I've written 2 books, and I'm working on a book of essays right now to explore some ideas that I have. And so there is writing. I'm always looking for the next wonderful book, hopefully a big book, you know, maybe a classic that I've missed somewhere along the line, that will take me to another dimension. And for sure, that's in my future. Traveling, I've done a lot of traveling. There are a few places I would like to see, but mostly novelty and living in New York City, and it's why I live here. Now, I came back to New York because I had great friends in California, but for novelty and for what I seek in life, which is to discover as much as I can, you know, that I'm capable of discovering. New York, it had to be a big city like New York. And although Los Angeles now, because of the art scene there, it's full of riches and music. But New York has another kind of novelty. It's a street novelty. So that every time you walk, and you walk all the time here, right? Every day you go out, something is going to happen. Something, you're going to have some encounter. You're going to see some bizarre thing. Remember when I first got back to New York, I was walking down the street, and on the steps of the church, there was a guy sitting there with a boa constrictor wrapped all around him. And as I was walking by, I'm looking at this, and there were 2 guys behind me, and one says to the other, "Now that's a real relationship." You know, that kind of thing. That,
yes.
You know, like just priceless moments.
Well, I have to say I was bi-coastal for about 5 or 6 years. And I wrote in one of my books that Los Angeles was the only city in the world that if you bring up the works of Milton, they say, "Burl?"
That's true.
So I was, I like the winters. To get away from the New York winters, I like being in L.A. That was okay, even though January rained a lot in L.A.
It does then. And there are many smart people in and my friends were just treasures in my life. But I just needed more stimulation on a daily basis. You can't be with your friends all the time. And
no.
I'm very glad that I made the move.
Well, I want to say in your second book, which is such an interesting title about living alone and loving it, what inspired that? What was the reason you wrote that book?
Well, after Lucien, who was the marriage, then I lived with Bert Nodala for 11 years on the coast. And then after that, I really wanted another relationship, but it wasn't happening. I moved back here, and I just wasn't meeting anybody that I was interested in or was interested in me. And at first, I was alarmed by that I was in my late 40s, and was I going to end up living alone? And I was struggling with that a little bit. But as time went on and through therapy, especially one particular psychoanalyst, I learned to think of myself as someone in the world, not just the partner of a guy. You know, up until that point, the man had been the center of my life always. And the few friends I had, because I was so focused on him, I didn't have a lot of friends. And the few friends I had were, you know, periphery. They weren't, you know, he was in the center ring. And as I began to look around and realize that I didn't need to be with the guy. I mean, I support myself nicely, and that was not necessary. And being alone gave me an opportunity to develop the interests that I wanted to develop, writing and reading and that kind of thing. And also that I had closed myself off from the world in general. Like this particular mentor of mine said, what about the druggist? What about the grocery person? What about the banker? These are human connections, you know, when I said I feel lonely or anything. And, you know, the Dalai Lama said, they asked him once if he was lonely. And he said, if I get lonely, I go down to the kitchen and I chat with the guy who sweeps the floor. Mm-hmm. You know, that I was specializing friends and relationships when there was a whole world of communication for me that I wasn't developing. And so I just began making friends, and some of them very, very close friends now, tremendous support group, and being more, you know, more alive to human connection. And that's probably the theme of the book, is that your happiness is in your own hands. And yes, if loneliness is an issue, that's in your hands too.
That's true. Yeah. I want to first of all, thank you for doing this show. And I want to ask you if you would be kind enough to tell me, in looking back on your career professionally now, not personally, you've written about personal enough, tell me what you considered the highlight or one of the highlights of your career so far.
In terms of satisfaction or in terms of just the amazingness of it?
I like satisfaction.
Satisfaction, yeah. Certainly in terms of material, because having a commercial career, the material is very commercial. Material might be very high level commercial, but it's commercial material. For years doing poetry readings and reading great poetry, and to people, and delivering, being able to deliver that, even to small audiences, you know, gave me, I think, the most satisfaction. I used to have a group that came here every week or two, and we would sing for each other, and often I would read poetry to them, and they were all professionals, and I mean, it was really such a lovely thing. And it was just us, you know, it was just like six of us. And that was probably as satisfying as anything I've ever done performing. But in terms of like a blast, Ben Johnson, for sure.
Right. And I guess after satisfaction, I would do one more and say, when you were the happiest professionally, again.
The happiest professionally? Okay. A few years in 1991, it's more than a few, I guess, I did a musical with Donna McKechnie and Georgia Engel called Cut the Ribbons, and it only lasted 2 weeks. And getting to know those women and getting to be on stage with them performing, singing. I've never felt safer on stage. I've never felt closer professionally to anyone. Backstage, before we went on, we were just hold hands and then go on. And we were so under-rehearsed for this play, of this musical, and it was done off-Broadway. And we were so under-rehearsed that the first night, the final song, production number, that we were very shaky on, Donna started singing her part. We sang first Donna, then Georgia, then me. And Donna began singing, and she went up on her lines.
Oh.
She lost. She didn't know what the lyric was. And then when it was George's time, she went up on her lines, and I did the same. And there was a certain point where we were all together, and Donna just said to the audience, "Can somebody help us? Would somebody like to help us?" That made me, I was never afraid of going up on a line after that again, because it was, the audience loved it. We loved it. And it just bonded us. And that was, that was just the best.
Well, I again want to thank you, because everything I hoped this interview would be has happened. You're charming, you're lovely, you're honest, you're interesting, and most importantly, you're a writer now. You're a writer now. You've done it. So thank you, Barbara, and I only hope you go to 99.
Oh, we're trying, working on it.
You're doing pretty terrific.
But Julian, you're an absolutely amazing interviewer. Oh. Thank you so much. It's your interest, your enthusiasm, your research, which is just phenomenal, and just you're so experienced at doing this. You're so good at it, and I'm probably the best interview I ever had. So I just want you to know that, and thank you so much for inviting me.
Thanks for joining us on Julian Schlossberg's Movie Talk. Remember to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Produced by Audavita Studios. Connect your voice to the world. Produced by Audavita Studios. Connect your voice to the world.